Yeah, so I'd like to tell you about some work I did with Valentin and a mathematician, Francesco Constantini, Constantino, on the duality between the 2D Ising model and 3D quantum gravity. this workshop is really about coarse grinding and renormalization in quantum gravity, which I believe is some very important question, both from the point of view of like fundamental point of view, if you think that the coarse grinding and randomization is intimately related to the dynamics of quantum gravity, or from an effective point of view, where you want to coarse grind the Planck scale dynamics up to like our scale or cosmological scales to get to extract correction, quantum gravity correction to the classical equations. So this is the perfect arena to use methods from statistical physics and condensed matter in quantum gravity. And usually these methods, we want to apply them in loop quantum gravity when we study the, when we try to evaluate the path integral or like the average, like the expression values of the dynamics or of observables and the evolving under the dynamics. So it usually comes in two possible ways. Either we try to look at the dynamics of the loop quantum gravity degrees of freedom on some fixed graph like a spin network or a spin form of fixed to complex. And so we do some stuff like lattice gauge theory and we try to evaluate the amplitudes from mean field or perturbation of some like more complex scheme. Or we try to look at the dynamics of a fluctuating graph. So like in matrix models or tensor models trying to, from the technical point of view, like looking at superposition of spin networks or summing of all two complexes and all that. And the point in, the hard point in quantum gravity that is in LQG is that you have both these ingredients. And so you try to do both things at the same time and try to get some results. So you coarse grain the degrees of freedom on some fixed lattice, but then your lattice changes and it's all fucked up. So it's not what I'm going to do. So the duality between some condensed matter, some statistical physics model and quantum gravity here is really, well, it's a mathematical relation. So it was not really physically motivated at the beginning, but then, so it really started as some duality between spin network evaluation, so purely mathematical objects and the Ising model. And then I put the physics back in afterwards. So we start with a 3D quantum gravity, which we can spin form quantize as the Poisson-Auger model. And then you can write all these amplitudes as recoupling symbols, SU2 recoupling symbols like the Fréhenger symbols, Sigge symbols, and all that. And you can write the generating function for these spin form amplitudes and show that it's some Gaussian integral. Then you can compute this Gaussian integral at some loop polynomial. And then it turns out that this is exactly the Poisson function of the Ising model. And so since it's exactly the same thing, then we say, oh, we found a duality between the 2D Ising model and 3D quantum gravity. So the result is exactly that. We first showed that the generating function for spin network evaluation can be written as some Gaussian integrals using spinner techniques. Then we showed that the Ising Poisson function on a fixed graph can also be written as some Gaussian integral, but this time in odd Grassmannian variables, so some kind of fermionic counterpart. And we showed that these two functions are equal, well, actually inverse of one of the other, and that this equality is realized through some supersymmetry relating the fermionic sector, which is the Ising model, to the bosonic sector, which is quantum gravity. So although this is just a mathematical result, I believe you can do a lot of physics with that. So first, like use all the statistical physics tools that you know how to use on the Ising model and use that in quantum gravity. So to talk about the phase diagram, the continuum limit, the critical couplings, and all that. Hopefully, we can also say something interesting about the Ising model using quantum gravity, what we know about quantum gravity. So you know all the asymptotics, Rydberg calculus, these things we've been doing all these years. Try to use that to say something interesting for the Ising model. And hopefully, this is generalizable to more complicated systems. Because on the one hand, the Ising model is the simplest statistical physics model that we know, and 3D quantum gravity is also our favorite toy model for quantum gravity. So I hope that these two models, you can lift them to something more complicated, like 4D quantum gravity, and maybe get some more complex model on the Ising side, and that this kind of duality can be applied there too. So the outline of my talk is, first I will talk about I will show how the Poisson energy amplitude can be written as spin network evaluations, basically by projecting all the dynamics on the boundary. I will construct the generating function for the spin network evaluation and compute them. I will do the same for the Ising parton function, and then I will use all this to reprove the Westbury theorem, saying that the generating function for the spin network amplitude is the inverse square of the Ising parton function, and I will show that through get some new proof of that through the supersymmetry. Then I will apply that to like higher order supersymmetric theories, like getting like some kind of more coupled Ising models to quantum gravity and still integrals that we can localize and compute exactly. I will explain to you the link that we get from that theorem between the criticality of the Ising model and our favorite calculation with spin network and spin form, that is asymptotic, like the saddle point calculation for spin networks. I will apply that to our favorite graph and give you some funny mathematical geometrical statements on the 6J. I will show you how you can use really this relation between the Ising model and 3D gravity to, for example, translate the things that we do when we coarse grain the Ising model into like what we do usually, like Packner moves for spin networks. And then I will go on with some kind of like speculation of what I'm hoping to get on the continuum limit of 3D gravity from the continuum limit of the Ising model. So for those who were at Loops this summer, this is more or less the same talk, but I added like 50 slides to it. So good luck. Okay. So let's start with 3D quantum gravity. So it's a topological quantum field theory. So everything is more or less like we believe it's very simple. There's no local degrees of freedom. And so you can put everything on the boundary. So we like this model because we can spin form quantize it exactly. It's the Poisson energy model. So you take a triangulation of your bulk, of your 3D bulk, or you can consider the spin form counterparts of a dual too complex to it. You put spins on every edge of your triangulation. And they represent the length of the quantized length of your edges. And then your Poisson energy amplitude is simply the product of the 6J symbols corresponding to each tetrahedra. You all know that well. And basically, through some gauge fixing and so on, you can exactly compute this guy by projecting it completely on the boundary. So I'm doing that for a topologically trivial case. So something where the boundary is simply topologically has two sphere and there's nothing in the bulk. So in that case, you can really show that the Poisson energy amplitude is simply a projector on the flat connection, also on flat holonomies. And so the resulting amplitude that you get is simply the evaluation of your boundary spin network. So your boundary spin network, basically, it represents, it's a free valent graph, which is the dual to the boundary triangulation. And so you have spins on your edges, either of the graph or the dual triangulation. And then you can construct the spin network corresponding to it, and you evaluate it at the identity. So this will basically amount to building the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient corresponding to each free valent vertex and gluing them together straightforwardly with the trivial holonomy. So when you do that, you just have to take care of like all the signs and dual maps on the edges. So these are all the epsilons that I've put there. And then what we spent a lot of time in our work, it was fixing all these signs It was some mathematical work. It was a pure pleasure doing that. Yeah. So we started with a planar graph. So I learned a lot of things on planar graphs, and so I learned about the Castellane orientations, which was the orientation that Castellane put on planar graph to be able to solve the Ising model in 2D, in terms of Pfaffian. So a Castellane orientation is that you're going to orient all the edges of your graph such that there's an odd number of clockwise oriented edges around each cycle of your graph. So why was that cool? It's because when you take this spin network evaluation and you switch the orientation of one edge, you get a sign which is -1 to the power twice the spin. And so if you start switching all the orientation, it's not very, I mean, you get arbitrary signs or like to, for your spin network evaluation. So you need to fix that. At least what we were able to show that if we choose any Castellane orientation, it always gives you the same result. So you can, there's not only one, a single Castellane orientation on a planar graph, but there might exist many which are related for some kind of elementary move. And you can always change all that, do this elementary move as long, and it will still give you the same result. So why did we choose this particular orientation and not some other random orientation? Is that this is the orientation that will make, allow us to make the link with the Ising partition function. Yes. Yeah. But you do that for like one orientation. And then we compute the generating function for that thing. So so you introduce some variables, some couplings for each edge, which I call big Y, which are basically going to be the conjugate variable to the spins, and you do you define you sum over all the spins with the evaluation and this beautiful statistical weight with factorials. So this is one weight for each triangle, and basically what you do is that you have on the triangle you have three spins J1, J2, J3. This is going to be the factorial of the sum of the free spin of the free spins plus one, so factorial of J1 plus J2 plus J3 plus one, divided by the factorial of J1 plus J2 minus J3, J1 minus J2 plus J3, and minus J1 plus J2 plus J3. So you do all the you put some minus sign in front of each spin. Is the sum of the free spins. And so if you want, this basically simply amounts to some kind of superposition of spin. I mean, it's a boundary state with a superposition of spin, and the statistical distribution of these spins is provided by this statistical weight here. And this, yes. So you might think, oh, it's some kind of like semi-classical coherent states with some nice properties that the spins are picked on something. So for example, when we build coherent states, spin network states, we like that the spins are all picked on some value of some the length of some 3D triangulation or 2D triangulations. And actually, that's almost what happens. But this definition differs from the standard coherent spin network definition by this factor J plus one factorial, which usually is at the denominator. And this, which makes that this stuff, yeah, I will say more on it later. But basically, instead of the spins being picked on some classical, on one length of a tetrahedron, I mean, of a triangulation, it will define a triangulation up to a global scale. So now that I defined this interesting function, I mean, why did we put this weight there? It's that because we are able to explicitly compute this integral, I mean, this sum. So how do we do that? Is that we're going to introduce the generating function for the free J symbol, which is the basic building block of this spin network evaluation. So you have this beautiful formula that that exists, that you can prove. I think Valentin find it in a paper from Bergman or something, or well, in a paper, old paper, very old. Bergman, yeah, the Bergman, yeah. So how does this formula works? Is that you introduce some, I mean, some variables like that, which are basically the complex variable, which are like the two components of a spinner, that you can try to ignore with a spinner for the moment. And what you do is that around each vertex, where you look at the 3D symbol, you're going to define a clockwise ordering of the edges. So this is possible to do that consistently on the whole graph because you have it's a planar graph, so you can choose an orientation for an anti-clockwise orientation for every vertex. And so that allow, and you introduce the angles, and you're going to define variables, x alpha, for each angle, which is going to be in terms of y variables, which were living on the edges, where here the notation that this is the source edge of the angle alpha, and this is the target edge of the angle alpha. And this is just the geometric mean, no, well, the square root average of this, simple. So this this generating function simply becomes, can be written as an exponential of this thing, where this is the antisymmetric combination of the x and w variables, which are auxiliary variables, corresponding on the source and target edge. So you sum over all the angles with this weird thing. So we like this, we introduce these factors simply to match these factors that are coming here in the generating function of a free J symbol. And then you take all the generating function, and you perform the sums, and you realize, oh, you can write it simply as some integral over these z's and w variables with some Gaussian weights. So now, so z's and w, as you saw here, they are attached to each edge at each vertex. So you have one z and one w per half edge. So that's what here. So you have one z and one w for each half edge on your graph. You've got this Gaussian weight. You've got this anti-holomorphic terms and these holomorphic terms. And basically what it does is that this guy generates the free J symbols. And then you use the big theorem on the Gaussian weight to glue these guys using this weight along the edges. So you're going to contract the generating function of the free J's using this anti-symmetric term on the edges. And so this way you're going to glue all your free J symbols into the whole graph and the spin network evaluation. So as I said, this is simply a Gaussian integral. So you can compute this guy as a beautiful determinant. And it's not really what I'm going to do here. What I'm going to do is that show how this is related to the Ising model. And since we know the result of the Ising model, we won't have to compute this determinant. But so with all the spinners everywhere, that's really something. So here we've written under like notation like Jeff, like in terms of spinners. So with the missile and the anti-missile, and the Gaussian weight, yeah. So, rocket? Oh, shit. I always call it a missile. Okay. Well, rocket and anti-rocket. And what? Oh yeah, so this doesn't really look like the way that we write spin form amplitudes or things like that. It's almost the same things as, for example, Jeff and Laurent computed, but they were using some spinner variable for each vertex and use them to group average. So you can do some little trick to go from this integral to the kind of integral they have. So it's exactly the same formula as Jeff shown this morning. So this is like the scalar product of coherent intertwiners with a group integral, and you have something like that. So like from there, you'd like to remove this factor, and so you can do that and you get to this kind of expression where you can rewrite the generating function for the three J's in terms of some Gaussian integral, where this new Z is going to live at each vertex. So you have one of these new spinners for each vertex. And then so you plug this formula into here, you integrate over all the half edge spinners, and you've got this new formula here. And so this shows how you go from like our way to do with half edge spinners to like a group of averaging spinners as you usually have in loop quantum gravity and spin forms. And what Jeff and Laurent did, it was take this thing and compute the huge determinant you get from that and show that you actually get something really close to like some rational function which looks like the Ising model. And then Jeff with Bianca showed, at least for in the case of the square lattice, that it's exactly the Ising model. So here, we're not going to use this formulation, but I just wanted to explain it because that's the usual way that we compute spin network evaluation in this room. But here, this formula is very adapted to working with, yeah?
Base going between the three edges, or is it different?
Yeah, it's the angle variable between.
So it's
in
U1.
No. It's an arbitrary variable. Yeah, it's in C. Yeah. So this formula is really adapted to free valent graphs, and later when we will want to generalize all that we're doing to like arbitrary valence. Probably this kind of integral, which doesn't care about the valency of the vertices, will be useful, but we haven't worked that out yet. So this is all the spin network side. So I have to tell you a bit about the Ising model. So this time in the Ising model, we take the same free valent graph and we put spins. But now spins are not half integers. They are like plus or minus one, which this kind of thing makes really hard each time I try to explain our work to people, because we have the same word spins for like a Z2 variable or a half integer. So so you sum over all Ising spins of just the, Ising the Hamiltonian with couplings small y's, one coupling for each edge. And then this kind of thing, you can, for example, compute it in the high temperature regime, and write it in some kind of like using the trick that you can linearize the exponential, because this is in Z2. You write it like that, where you sum over still all the spins and you have this product for each edge. And that allows you to write it as a loop, to do a loop expansion of that. So meaning that you can write the Ising partition function as the sum over all even subgraphs, which are the subgraphs of your graph such that the valency of the nodes of the subgraph are all even. So since here it's a free valent graph that you start with, it can be either zero or two. So basically your even subgraph is just a disjoint set of loops living on your initial graph. So this is the sum of all set of loops on your graph, and you multiply this coefficient big Y, which have a hyperbolic tangent of the small Ising couplings along all your loops. You put a beta, you mean you want to put a temperature beta here? What I'm saying is that this is the expansion that people use when they study the Ising model at high temperature. We use this expansion. There's another expansion which is better suited for like low temperature, which is actually dual to that one. But yes, this guy is going to be an expansion in betas, in power of betas, if you want. But here it's just a terminology, the higher temperature or low temperature. So the point is that this loop expansion allows us to like reformulate the eigenproportion function as some fermionic path integral. Well, path integral, some Gaussian integrals over spinners. So once again, you're going to introduce variables for each half edge. So this time it's not really a spinner, it's a fermionic variable, well, an odd Grassmann variable. And you have one factor, one action term for each edge, basically saying how you glue the fermion on one side of the edge to the fermion on the other side. And you have, and you're going to introduce angle couplings through some angle term action, where you basically are going to, when you glue fermion, two fermions on one edge, on one angle, you're going to put the coupling X alpha there. And so this is a Gaussian integral, so you can compute it exactly, you expand it. And so you, what you're going to see is that when you expand this fermion thing, so really you can really expand it, because this is the exponential, but these are fermionic, so you, it's just a polynomial. And so you look at the highest order in all fermions and you compute the determinant, kind of. So what happens is that here when you look at the terms, you're going to take these angle terms and you're going to glue them along the edges. So you each time you insert something like that between terms like that, and you look, and you keep track of all the signs, and then you show that this thing is exactly that because we chose a Castellane orientation and an anti-clockwise orientation around each vertex. And then this formula looked a bit too simple, so we went to the Ising squared, and then we mixed all the variables together. And we showed that you can rewrite it like that, with this Gaussian term, which basically is the measure on all these half-edge fermions, this anti-holomorphic term, which lives on the edges, and then this angle term action. And when it's written like that, it really looks like the action, the Gaussian integral I wrote for the spin network generating function. So, of course, since these are all Gaussian integrals, we can be computed explicitly because, well, many people did that before us. So we know the results, so we checked that we get the same thing. And you can really show that actually the square of this fermionic integral times the generating function of the spin is simply one. And so this gives you like this formula relating the generating function of the spin networks to the Ising model. And this is just the prefactor that was in front of the Ising model partition function. So this is the formula encompassing this duality between the 2D Ising model and the spin network evaluation, defining the spin form amplitudes for the 3J for the 3D quantum gravity. So this is something that was more or less already known as the Westbury theorem, and also proved by other people, and also used by Bianca and Jeff in that paper where they suggested using this formula to look at critical phenomena in 3D quantum gravity. So one way is to compute these Gaussian integrals explicitly, but what we did, it was trying to avoid to compute these things and simply showed this formula by showing that really there's a supersymmetry in this meta theory, having like one copy of the quantum gravity and two copies of the Ising model, and showing that this theory is trivial, so that the partition, the meta partition function will be one, simply because there's a supersymmetry relating these two sectors. So this big partition function has variables which are the half-edge spinners and then the half-edge fermions. And you can regroup all the terms in some like Gaussian terms on all the half edge, some edge action, and some angle action. So this is the Gaussian, this is the anti-holomorphic part, and this is the holomorphic part. And then you can show that all these terms are, I mean, all this thing is trivial due to some supersymmetry. And the supersymmetry generator is very simple. On each half edge, it sends the spinners onto the fermions and vice versa. And then you can show that all these three terms are both Q exact and Q closed. So the best case scenario, eh? After all, it was just a Gaussian integral. It's kind of overkilling it, but you can use that to show that this beautiful pattern function doesn't care about any of the couplings that you introduced. And so you can evaluate it at couplings all zero, and it gives you one. Okay. I don't know, it was so simple, I didn't give it a name.
When you just take some, you z goes to psi, then psi goes to w, and w to eta, then eta to z. So you're back to your
minus star.
Yeah, it's a pessimist. It's from your little higher minus somewhere.
The minus sign.
So what can we do with that relation? So the first reflex is to try to map spin correlation to spin correlation. I mean, so you take averages of the spins of a length in the spin network, and you map it into Ising correlations. So that's your first reflex. You can also, so you have a supersymmetry on some Gaussian, some quadratic action. It's not much fun, so we try to get higher order supersymmetric actions. But then I also want to get some phase diagram for spin network evaluation, and maybe talk about the continuum limit of quantum gravity amplitudes. Yeah? So let's start with the simplest. So you have this relation between the Ising squared Poisson function and the spin network generating function. If you take a derivative of this relation with respect to the couplings, then it will give you a relation between the Ising spin correlation and the spin averages, where the spin the Ising correlations are defined with respect to the Ising weight and the Ising Hamiltonian, and these are defined with respect to the weight defined by the spin network evaluation and our statistical weights. So after working a bit, you find you do the case for one spin on one edge, and you find that the average of the spin on that edge is related to the nearest neighbor correlation of the Ising model. And then you push this a bit further, and you can show that there's a relation between, like, if you look at the non-nearest neighbor correlation, so you take two vertices on your graph, and you look at the correlation between the Ising correlation between the spins, then you can rewrite it in terms of average of the spins along on your graph. So what you do is that you actually have to choose a path between your two vertices. And this correlation will depend on all the correlations of the edges along that path. So there's, of course, this little C that I've put there, which means it's not as simple as it looks. So basically, on that side, you're going to do the correlation. I mean, it's basically a splitting on your path into many a portion of your path. And here, for example, if you take a partition with like a single point in between, you're going to do the correlation between these two spins minus the correlation, the product of the correlation of between these two spins and these two spins. Yeah, it's what I connected. That's why I put a small c. And here it's kind of the same. If you split the thing, you're going to look at the average of the product of the two averages of the product of the SU2 spins along that path times the average of the SU2 spins on the other one. So it's just that this thing is actually a product of correlation, and this thing is a product of correlation. And if you want just like expressing just the correlation between these two Ising spins in terms of averages of spin network spins, then it's very complicated. But at least you can get the average of the spins and from the spin network from the exactly known correlation between nearest neighbor, and you get this beautiful plot that Valentin did for us. So you see the average of the spin plus 1/2 in terms of the coupling constant, and here he took the derivative, so that you see clearly that there's a divergence. It's somewhere around here. You don't really see it, but it's the derivative is discontinuous. There's like a corner here.
So you say that, but I'm.
You compute the average, this average,
this
for
this
just one edge.
Yeah.
And so you can get that function exactly from the nearest neighbor Ising correlation.
Yeah. So it's basically, I'm just asking, I mean, basically, I'm just confirming for me what is the partition function for G? This is a.
For J.
In which this average is computed.
Yeah.
That's basically the Ising partition function, but we
wouldn't know J variables. Yeah, if you want. And this beautiful average, you see that it starts for J plus 1. So the average of the spin starts at 0 and then goes to minus 1 half. So then you look puzzled. You look very puzzled. It's the coupling, yeah, so it's the temperature. You look very puzzled by that. Then you realize that this is not some expectation value of spins on some graph. It's actually you take your boundary spin network, or it's here, like ket boundary spin network. You do a spin insertion, and here you project all that on the flat state. So it's not some expectation value; it's some more like matrix element of a spin. That's why it has this weird behavior. Else, it would be larger than one, larger than zero, at least. Yeah. But at least you got some phase transition. So that's for the spin averages. Then we try to go to some higher order supersymmetric theory, so to get some integrals which are non-trivial, a bit harder to compute than the Gaussian integral. So as I said, up to now we've been working with some like the product of Ising models and the spin integrating function, but you can couple them a bit more. So you had these three terms, which were like supersymmetric, and you can go to some higher order supersymmetric theory by simply putting these action terms to some arbitrary power. So this will still give you supersymmetric theories. So the integrals, the partition function, will still be localized, and so will still be trivial, except that now the Ising models will be coupled to your 3D gravity, so to your geometry. So if you add, like for example, like higher order angle terms, then you will first have change the spin network distributions, so it will not be the same boundary state, so it will change the saddle point and all that. You will get some term coupling the Ising to the spin network, some kind of like geometry dependent couplings for the Ising models. And it will also couple the two Ising models. We haven't found some physical interpretation for these theories yet, but we can compute their partition function. So what's more interesting for me, it's the relation between like the criticality of the Ising model and how can we translate this criticality for the Ising model to something on the gravity side, so on spin network and spin forms. So what we usually do with spin network amplitude or spin form amplitude is that we like to take the large spin limit. In the large spin limit, you get some asymptotics and you look at the saddle point, and then you interpret the saddle point geometrically. So we're going to do just that. You start with your generating function, which had this spin network evaluation, this ugly, this beautiful weight, and this coupling terms. And for example, we focus on everything but the spin network evaluation, so all that. And we do the large spin limit, and we try to understand what these spins are picked on, and do they have a geometrical interpretation. So you use the Stirling formula for all factorials, you expand all that, you get a beautiful action, you compute the saddle point. Then you realize that, as usual, there's a stationary point as soon as all the spins, J, are the length of the edges of a triangulation dual to your graph. So you have your graph, your trivalent graph, you build a dual triangulations, and your spins J's have a length of these edges. But this triangulation is not arbitrary. It's actually, this triangulation needs to be determined in terms of your coupling, so the y's. And so the relation between the y's to the triangulation is that the y's are determined in terms of the angles of your triangles. So if you take one edge, you look at the two triangles that share it, you look at the opposite angles, and this gives you the coupling y. So if you start with a triangulation such that these y's are given by this formula, then you have a saddle point. And actually, this saddle point is not really a saddle point, it's a saddle line, meaning that this relation doesn't care about the, doesn't give you any scale. It doesn't tell you that the, well, right, there's no scale, there's no length in there. So basically, once you have that, you can rescale. If you start with a saddle point, so the triangulation such that the spins are the length, you can rescale that to some like arbitrarily big or arbitrarily small, and it will still be a saddle point.
So global scaling, you have to scale the
entire triangle. Yes, global scale. So we were kind of puzzled by this relation, so we try to relate it to something which we know on the Ising side. So we applied this formula to a regular honeycomb network because it was the simplest network which is free-valent and regular. And it turns out that this formula gives you 1 over square root of 3, which turns out to be the critical coupling for the Ising model. Okay, cool. Maybe it's a numerical coincidence. So we went to other critical couplings which are known for the Ising model, which are for isoradial graphs. So an isoradial graph is such that every face of your triangle, of your graph, all the points can be inscribed in their circumscribed circle, which all have the same radius. So here, like you see, like this is going to be a face of your graph, and all these circles have the same radius, and then. The intersection points of your circle define the graph, and then you can build the dual triangulation by linking the centers of your circles. This beautiful drawing was done by Valentin. And then in that case, people showed that the critical couplings is given by the rhombus, the tangent of the half rhombus angle, which turns out to be exactly our formula. So we had an infinite class of graph that such that our couplings were the Ising couplings. So it looked promising. Discrete complex structure.
I don't know more. It's something in mathematics actually that you can define.
Yeah, on the graph, yeah, you can define some discrete differential calculus on the graphs and all that. Yeah.
And this is
discrete homomorphism.
Yeah. But I don't know how this is related to our stuff. I don't know at all. Maybe in the continuum limit, it's useful. I have no clue. So basically what happens here is that if you look at our geometric couplings, so defined by this relation, so this gives you a scaling variant to saddle points, which basically leads to a pole in the generating function of the spin network's evaluation. So it diverges at that point. And so since the Ising Poisson function is the inverse, it will be a zero of the Poisson function of the Ising model, which is a critical coupling of Fischer zero. So this way we hope that to show that all the saddle points of this Poisson function are actually all the zeros of the Ising model. And so we started testing this idea on the tetrahedron, always. It's always there. So we looked at the generating function for the CG symbols. We looked at really the full saddle points. So not only of the statistical weight, but combining it with the asymptotics of the CG symbol, because for a moment we ignore the spin network evaluation asymptotics. So since for the CG symbol we know it's given by the radiaction, we can study the full saddle point for in the large spin asymptotics. And so this allowed us to give some to get some real geometrical interpretations for Fischer zeros on the tetrahedral graph. This was a purely mathematical question because I don't think physicists care about Ising model on the tetrahedral. That's a So this is work with Valentin and one of my students. So basically, you use the asymptotics of CJ symbols in terms of a radial action, which is simply the sum of the lengths of the edges times the dihedral angle corresponding. And you can get a formula for the critical couplings, such that here it's still the same thing as I wrote before, determined like the modulus of these critical couplings is given by the 2D angles. So for one edge, you look at the opposite angles. And then the phase of these guys is actually the dihedral angle. So up to now, we were having real critical couplings. But here, since it's finite graph, I mean, the critical couplings for the Eysenck model are actually complex. And so it was very nice to have a simple geometrical interpretation of a phase in terms of geometry. So yeah, no. Our proofs of that, it was very nice to see it on a spherical tetrahedron. I mean, I spent some time on that. I talk about it, I like it. It's basically you can, I mean, all of these couplings actually scale invariant. So if you take your tetrahedra big or small, it doesn't really matter. So it tells you maybe you can have a simpler geometrical interpretation of these couplings. So after looking back at my simple geometry of like when I was at school, you look at the inscribed sphere of your tetrahedron, and you look at the four contact points of this inscribed sphere with your triangles. And so you have four new points, and that defines you a new tetrahedron on the inscribed sphere. And all this data is actually, these are still the lengths between the points on your sphere. So you have a sphere, you have four points. The dihedral angles are simply the distance between these points, and these are the angles of your 2D spherical triangles. And so basically this formula can be, you take any random four points on a sphere, and you can build all of these guys. So I like that because it showed how this is related to spherical geometry, just for fun. But the important lesson from that is that the phase of these critical couplings actually comes from the extracting curvature of the embedding of your 2D triangulation into the 3D space. Wow. Oh yeah, so a little remark is that these guys tells you that if you start with a tetrahedron and you remove the scale, so basically you have five parameters, this gives you these critical couplings. And then what the claim was that these critical couplings are the roots of the polynomial, of the loop polynomial defining the Eysenck partition function, which I wrote here for the Eysenck model on the tetrahedron. So this is a polynomial in C6, and so it will have many roots, like a 10-dimensional space of solution, whereas I only have a 5-dimensional space of solution. So it seems that we're missing a lot. But the trick is that here, for a moment, we looked only at real tetrahedrons. And so if you really do the saddle point of some function in the complex plane, you need to do the analytic continuation of all your terms and look for all the complex solution to that. And so this will require having the complex continuation of the 6J's and the factorial weights. Factorial weights are all right. It's the 6J's which are a bit annoying. But we have intuition that maybe it's just going to from real tetrahedrons to complex tetrahedrons. So we plug this idea on a computer, meaning like you decide to take complex dihedral angles, being still zeros of having a vanishing Gram determinant. And we construct these guys up to taking some square root problem. And we showed that it's always a root of this polynomial. But then Valentin tried to show the inverse mathematical statement, and it was too painful to go on. So it's work in progress. I don't know. I don't know how to do analytic controversy. So in a moment, we simply try to analytically continuate our solutions to like complex iterators. We didn't tackle the complex suggestion.
So,
like, since we like iterators, we can go on with a iterator and push it as far as we want. So as I said earlier, there's a high temperature expansion for Ising model, and there's a low temperature expansion for the Ising model. In terms, the high temperature is in terms of loops on the graph, and the low temperature expansion is in terms of loops on the dual graph, which is the same formula. Except that the couplings are a bit different. So like you can relate the Ising-Parchin function on the planar graph to the Ising-Parchin function of the dual graph. And the relation between these two guys is actually maps a high temperature onto a low temperature and vice versa. And so this is the mapping between the couplings, which is can be understood simply as an inversion on the Riemann sphere. The duality point. Okay. So the fixed point of this duality is this coupling, which is the critical coupling for the square lattice. Why? It's because the square lattice is self-dual to itself, and so you can simply get the critical coupling by this by the fixed point of this duality transformation, which is actually really cool. It doesn't really work for the tetrahedron. No, I mean, it works like that, but it's not that coupling, and the coupling is not known. No, it's something weirder happens for the tetrahedron. I'll just say, well, am I going to say it? No, I'm not. Actually, so we try to do this duality transform for the tetrahedron. So yes, it maps a critical coupling on the tetrahedron to another critical coupling on the opposite tetrahedron, so meaning like you switch the opposite edges. But so it led me to the quest of finding the dual tetrahedron. But actually, when you take the dual of the critical couplings of the tetrahedron, you go out of this five-dimensional nice sub-manifold. And so you have to go, the dual of the tetrahedron will be a complex tetrahedron. And since I don't know, I didn't find out how to define them, I couldn't find it. But it works for isoradial tetrahedrons. Yes. I was happy of that. Yeah. But basically, this duality allows us to relate the spin network partition generating function on the tetrahedra and the dual tetrahedra, which allows us to give a new duality formula for the sigj symbol in terms of the sigj and its dual. So you switch the two lines, tuck, tuck. And you've got this beautiful coefficient there, which relates these two, which can be obtained as by the power expansion of this function. Uh-huh. So we show it's a beautiful result, but we haven't found out how to use it yet. But at least the lesson that we get from studying the tetrahedron is that the critical you'll have a geometrical interpretation of the critical couplings for Ising model in terms of like the 3D embedding of your graph. So your graph is planar, but it's not flat. And then the dihedral angles between the faces will give you the phases of your critical couplings. And then this duality between low temperature and high temperature, it's pretty useful to locate the critical points and so on. So maybe it's another way towards finding critical points for the spin network evaluations. So one other thing which is really known for the Ising model, it's the coarse graining of the Ising model. And here I'm not going to talk about tensor network randomization. I'm just going to talk about like very simple coarse graining, and how to relate them to the Packner moves, 2D Packner moves, yeah? So on the boundary surface. So one relation that Valentin taught me was very fundamental to the Ising model is the star triangle relation, which is basically changing something like that in your graph. So you have four spins, Ising spins, and here you map it to three Ising spins. And the star triangle relation actually allows you to solve exactly the Ising model on the honeycomb lattice. And you can show that it's related to the Young-Baxter equation when you, well, it is basically the same thing as the Young-Baxter equation. And you can use this triangle relation on the Ising model. So you know how the two Bertrand function of Ising models are related to actually get the free one partner move on the generating function of a spin network. So going from there to that. So you just have to add these little legs, but it's pretty easy. And you know that this in the generating function, I mean, the spin network evaluation will be rated by some 6J's, but then there's some ugly thing with all the couplings and all that. But all this will be easy to repackage and to show it's, you can show it's equivalent to the star triangle relation for the Ising model. And then this is the free one partner move. The other nice move that we know is the 2-2, which is also related by a CJ symbol. And I was trying to look at its Ising equivalent. And well, at the beginning I couldn't find, but then talking to Joseph, he reminded me that the Ising Bertrand function is simply the multivariate tooth polynomial. And he loves the recursion relation for the tooth polynomial, which is basically you, if you have two vertices, you can either remove the edge or contract the edge. And so you can use the recursion relation on the multivariate tooth polynomial to get exactly the same result as you get from the partner move here. So my hope there is to translate everything of the spin network and spin form from there to there and try to see how much you can get about the phase diagram and critical phenomena of the Ising model for just from just these relations. Actually, you can get almost everything. And so, like, for example, like, my point would be, like, if I start forgetting about this side, how much can I get on criticality from just the free one partner move or vice versa? But this is just ideas. So, and I'll end my talk with some speculation about using the, what's known on the Ising model to get the continuum limit theory of 3D gravity as a boundary CFT. So for the Ising model, we know well how to describe the continuum limit at the critical point. So we know it's going to be some conformal field theory. And so we'd like to find how this conformal field theory is related to the Pontano Reggio model. So the goal is to close a circle. So you start with 3D quantum gravity. And we know that 3D quantum gravity is the quantization of 3D gravity, which is a Chern-Simon action in the bulk, which induces a Wesemann-Witten conformal field theory on the boundary. So this is nice, and that's how like Witten and all these other guys do it. But we decided to go the Pontano-Reggio way. So we have spin forms. From the spin forms, you can compute the amplitude and give you the spin network evaluation. But we just showed a related some boundary Ising model, which at the critical point, you can show it's actually a conformal field theory, which is a Wesemann-Witten theory. It's a Wesemann-Witten theory on a coset space, which is basically SU2 of level 2 quotiented by SU. And so you build the Wesemann-Witten theory on this beautiful coset. And And this is the coset Wesemann-Witten theory, which describes the Ising model. And that has a central charge, which is 1/2. It's the Ising model. Yeah. And so there, what you have to do from to close the circle is to take the inverse of the Wesemann-Witten theory and to show it's another Wesemann-Witten theory. And I was very puzzled because usually, actually nobody knew how to tell me, like, if you have a Bertrand function of a CFT, what is this, the theory which gives you the inverse of a Bertrand function? That's something very weird. Maybe I can do the complex conjugate or things like that. And so I went to see a guy down my corridor in Lyon, Gawetsky, that told me he did that in the 80s. And you do that by an analytical continuation, by changing this coset into a coset of SL2C, quotiented by SU2, level 2, which I don't know what it means, quotiented by the same coset. So basically, by taking the complex gauge group and taking the coset of the complex gauge group by your gauge group, you manage to inverse the Wiseman-Newton theory, which basically amounts of continuing the level of your theory to negative values of your level. So everything, the solution, is in analytical continuation for those who want to do that. Well, that I don't know because I haven't understood how this works, so I couldn't close the loop. So this is where I'm stuck. Yeah, but I mean here it's you're going to get the square of that guy because
two copies of because of the two copies of the Ensign model, right?
Yeah.
But we know there are two copies of the chiral was written so it seems to fit.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, numerology on one or two. I like it. It's okay. But the point is that the theory that we will want is will be a central of minus one, which is a non-unitary CFT, and I don't know what it means for gravity. So that's one way to close the circle. Another way, which I recently found out by learning more about the Tout polynomial, is that the multivariate Tout polynomial is actually the Jones polynomial on the chain mail link, which actually the class of graph that Laurent and David Louapre used after gauge fixing of the Ponzano-Reggie model to show the equivalence between the Ponzano-Reggie model and the Chern-Simon action on the double of SU2. So I think it's some other thing that I should learn, I guess, yes. Is that since then the Jones polynomial is the expression value of Wilson loops of Chern-Simon theory, that will allow you to go again to find another route between this Ising model and the Chern-Simon theory for quantum gravity. So this is all speculations, but anybody can help. So this is my conclusion slide on the perspective. So the first thing, it's all about technical improvements. I mean, I'd like to go to arbitrary valence for graph, go to non-planar graph. I mean, there's already calculations we've been done with that to show that it's not really the Ising-Poisson function, but it's a certain type of correlation of the Ising model. It'd be cool to go to add a magnetic field to the Ising model and see what its spin-network counterpart is, because the result of results, which I got on the zeros of the Ising model with fugacity, and that's the Li-Yang theorem, saying that in the continuum limit, all the zeros of fugacity are on the unit circles. And then when I read Connors Matter papers on that, we could get some critical phenomena in the dynamics of Ising model, like cool stuff. Anyway, it'd be nice to go Q-deformed, as usual, and maybe generalize the Ising model to other models and see what its spin network counterpart like. Like if you go to a POTS model, does there exist some dual model in the quantum gravity sector? We still need to find a nice proof for the full saddle points for arbitrary graph, and to show the that our geometric characterization of the Fischer zeros is actually suitable. Like all this higher order supersymmetric theory, we'd like to find a use for them. I'd like to apply all that to spin glasses, because basically spin glass, it's like the usual Ising model, it's putting all the couplings on all the edges to be the same, but the spin glass is putting some Gaussian distribution or random distribution of these couplings. So since now we can characterize all the zeros of like all this thing, then maybe we can say something about the Poisson function of the Ising spin glasses, or maybe simply reformulate all the problems in terms of like random geometry, 2D geometry on the boundary of a 3D quantum gravity. My collaborators don't want to, but I want to have more fun with tetrahedron. Yes. And really finish the proof, really understand the use of the duality formula on the CJ symbols and what it means, and maybe find the dual tetrahedron, the dual complex tetrahedron. Yeah, but now here it's a complex tetrahedron, so I don't know where it lives. But yeah. Complex dihedral angles, I have no clue how to deal with complex dihedral angles. One thing that everybody tells me that we should do is sum of the triangulations, because it's really natural from the quantum gravity part, and it's also something very interesting from the Ising, from statistical physics part, since like my first slide was about like saying like one of the hardest things in quantum gravity is really understand, I mean, mix the two sectors of chain fluctuating graph and integrating out degrees of freedom on a fixed graph. This is the hard part. So we know how to do it for the Ising model, how to sum of ultra integration done by Kazakov and other people. So maybe we can combine these two and sum our product of the Ising Poisson function and of quantum gravity of the ultra integration. I know that the result will be trivial because the product is one. So maybe we can extract what changes from quantum gravity, knowing the behavior of the Ising Poisson function on random triangulations. And finally, there's all this work on continuum limit, like closing the circle of Wezumino conformal field theory stuff that I like to do, and get understand finally how to extract a boundary conformal theory for spinform models, like from Poisson origin model, but then I really like to go to 4D and to try to get some CFT description for 4D spin forms. And that's all.
More questions?
I was a bit surprised to learn that the star triangle relation is related to the state one polynomial, because usually I got the impression that the 2-2 polynomial is more non-trivial thing.
So the 2-2 back remove is more related.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's more related to gauge invariance. Mm-hmm. Invariance in MSU2, because you can always gauge fix the element, the group element on your edge to the identity. Mm-hmm. And then you have the four valence twiner, and you split it the other way around.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then you reintroduce your group element.
Okay.
So in 2D, the 2-2 back move is more related to gauge invariance. So that's why it's that's relation.
That's three,
one, so. But to perform the 3-1 back move, you really need the Hamiltonian constraint, and that's kind of equivalent to the Young-Baxter equation.
Uh-huh.
So you can really use the star triangle to do that.
Well, that was because of, okay, reminding me of a paper which was looking at models which are only invariant and not true, but not under C1 invariant. Pentley, I think.
Who?
Pentley.
Yeah.
Oh, I can be.
But I like also this relation, because it's how they, I mean, it's how we define the two polynomial. Can be completely characterized by this regression relation, which basically tells you how to cause grain. But I haven't understood the relation between these two.
Okay. Like also in the paper, this Wojtek, we look for topological invariant models by solving the conditions. And the 2-2 polynomial was also much more not trivial. It was a C1. Reduces to the bubble
itself.
But then here, I don't know if it's
invariance
or is it some other thing.
Well, Baxter showed that you can completely solve the 2D IT model using only the star triangle relation.
Yeah.
So maybe it contains that relation.
Also,
but on the quantum gravity side, it's a 3-1 pack move is enough to get the whole. All information on the generating function.
Yeah, is it an invariance move?
I don't know. I thought you were doing things on like discarding the 2-2 move or like in a higher dimension and just focusing on.
No, in the paper with Wojtek, we looked. I mean, we looked at 2D topological field series,
mm-hmm.
and we put constructs. and the much more non-trivial move is the 2-2 move. Because the 3-1 move you can reduce to this bubble thing. So the bubble thing is just kind of a normalization.
But, for what you said, that the star triangle relation is enough to solve the 2D algebra, but it's only for like the regular honeycomb and the regular square lattice.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe for the arbitrary graph, you might need the other one, like to change a bit.
Well, you definitely need the 2-2 move if you want an arbitrary graph and you want the physical state for 3D gravity. You totally need the 2-2 move because otherwise you can just get you can only solve the Hamiltonian constraint on basis of degree 3 on triangles.
But maybe as you were saying, it's pure gauge because I get the 2-2 move by squaring that guy. So I coarse grain and I decoarse grain. So maybe
yes.
It's trivial.
Is there an interpretation of what would be on the IC model side if you were to quantum deform as you do the same thing with the Turiya-Fira model?
I have no clue. I'm waiting for people to compute the gelatin function from the Q deform case.
They all sort of somehow related to some stuff Kaufmann did, but didn't you look at the Potts model?
Yeah, I didn't get it super far.
But I thought there should be something in Kaufmann stuff, but I didn't never found where Kaufmann's book.
Mm-hmm. No, I have no clue about the QD formula.
So, since Sebastian is not asking this question, because Sebastian considered also, like, say, spin network, 2D spin network coupled to an easy model. But here you can do something with having these supersymmetric combinations.
Yeah, when you go to the higher order, you have Ising coupled to the geometry. But I don't know if it's the same.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it would be interesting to see that, how the coupling nicely works, and is it already kind of a nice cylindrical consistent theory in a sense, and how does the coupling then relate? I mean, what is the coupling in terms of geometry? Can you extract a running coupling? That would be great.
It would be nice to have a use for these integrals we can compute.
Yeah, the problem that the integrals are not Gaussian if you use the higher order actions.
Yeah, so they're hard to compute. But
yeah. We know how to compute them, but to interpret them, the standard rule would be to expand the exponential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if it's a Gaussian theory, it's clear that you get loose because, I mean, everything is linear. You don't get vertices of degree 3 or 4. So you get loops. But if it's a higher order theory, that's not Gaussian, it's not clear what the physical interpretation is. I mean, you have Feynman rules that are much more famous.
But at least, I mean what we get is that the model where the Poisson function of Ising coupled to geometry is going to be exactly given by something which is pure gravity times pure Ising models coupled. So it's kind of like some decoupling formula for the Ising model and the geometry. So maybe, and then it's just a problem of doing a new saddle point in J's and solving the coupled Ising model. But that I think guys know how to do that. So maybe you can.
More comments? Okay, if not, then let's get it out again.